Hi, it's Maria Hinojosa, host of Latino USA. We all love great stories. And great stories are what we pride ourselves in delivering to you every week. Latino USA presents a mix of reporting on culture and politics, diverse voices, and coverage of current and emerging issues, featuring stories that will make you think and maybe even inspire you. Listen to Latino USA on your favorite podcast app from PRX.
Two disaster relief groups suspend their work in Gaza after the Israel Defense Forces kill 7 aid workers.
It's a pretty big stretch to say that this was an accident and it was unintentional. They were in 3 vehicles and each one of them appears to have been targeted in succession.
The overnight attack hit one of the few groups distributing food aid in Gaza. An Israeli military expert says those incidents are unfortunate, but
nothing creates a situation that is 100% safe for all civilians. And mistakes are being done.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also ahead, tens of thousands of French kids having trouble with math are turning to this guy. Petite chanson sur les tables de multiplication. That is coming up today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us today. An Israeli airstrike in Gaza overnight killed 7 aid workers from the relief group World Central Kitchen. The aid workers had just left a warehouse in armored vehicles. The group's logo was printed across the roofs of those vehicles to make them identifiable from the air. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the incident tragic and said Israeli forces unintentionally hit innocent people. Among the dead were 3 British nationals, an Australian, a Polish national, an American-Canadian dual citizen, and a Palestinian. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese called for greater protection for aid workers.
We want full accountability for this, because this is a tragedy that should never have occurred.
The World Central Kitchen has since halted its Gaza operations. So has its longtime partner, ANIRA, American Near East Refugee Aid. Sean Carroll is ANIRA's CEO. Sean, I know your staffers work very closely on the ground with some of those killed yesterday. So this must be a very emotional moment for you. Is that right?
It is. It is very much so. And particularly for our staff that we're working day in and day out, both in person and over WhatsApp chat groups. In Cairo, in Gaza, in Amman, it's hit them very, very hard.
I gather you talked to Jose Andres, the head of World Central Kitchen, last night. How did the two of you make any sense of what has happened?
You can't make any sense of what's happened, and we haven't heard a good explanation yet. We're not experts in investigation of bomb scenes, but I think it's a pretty big stretch to say that this was an accident and it was unintentional. They were in 3 vehicles, and each one of them appears to have been targeted in succession. I've heard horrifying accounts of what actually happened, and I think in any context around the world, this would be called a brazen act of cowardice, senseless, unjustified, no explanation is possible. And so I think the world needs to, before it hangs its head in shame, needs to scratch its head and ask some really tough questions. How could this happen? How did we get to this point?
So you don't believe the Israeli assertion that this was an accident?
I mean, looking at the photos and the videos, how could that be an accident? 3 separate vehicles were hit. I would imagine World Central Kitchen is going to want a better explanation than that. And we're still waiting for an explanation on the death of our staffer. Musa Shawa was killed just under a month ago, and his 6-year-old son died a few days after of his wounds. And we've also not gotten an explanation.
Both your group and World Central Kitchen coordinate with the Israeli military over the movement of your aid vehicles, I understand. Can you explain how that works?
Yeah, I mean, this is a standard operating procedure in areas of conflict, in war zones, where humanitarian organizations and workers deconflict with the warring parties, let them know who we are, where we are, what we're doing. We deconflicted many times over the last few months with Israeli authorities, with the military, on where our shelters are, that we're sheltering our staff and their families, where our offices, our distribution centers, our cars. And my understanding, I have no reason to doubt it, is World Central Kitchen had done all of that, including names of drivers and license plates, and their cars were all clearly marked, and two of them were armored cars. So this is not easily explained, and it needs to be explained because humanitarian aid needs to continue, obviously for the sake of Palestinians, but also for the long-term security of Israel. There can't be security for Israel. There can't be any semblance of peace and living side by side in equal measures of peace and safety and security and dignity when these senseless acts make it so that people can't understand how they could live side by side and for the sake of humanity.
Mm. Can you tell me more about how aid groups such as yourself and World Central Kitchen actually get aid in and out of Gaza? What is that process like, and what is your footprint on the ground?
Well, it's far too difficult. Our footprint on the ground is not large, but it's very effective. It's very trusted, well-known. We have a good reputation. Anira has been working in Palestine, in the occupied Palestinian territories, for over 55 years. We've been in the same office for 40 years until we had to leave it at the beginning of this war in Gaza City, but we still have staff in Gaza City. We have staff in Rafah. We did have staff in the middle area in Derbala, where this attack took place, until they actually had to evacuate the shelter they were in. They were feeling relatively safe. The shelter was deconflicted, but three bullet holes went through the windows in late December, early January, and we still don't have an explanation on that either. So staff, like everyone else in Gaza, have moved, have been evacuated several times. They live in fear all the time. And we, like World Central Kitchen, have made the difficult and extremely unfortunate decision to pause our operations because of the lack of safety. Our staff, until now, until this attack, every day had said, we're going to keep delivering aid. Yes, we're fearful. We fear for our lives. We really fear for our families' lives, but we're going to keep delivering aid if it's the last thing we do. And now they've finally said we can't operate. International law, humanitarian law, does call for the occupying power or the power that controls the population, in this case Israel. It is their responsibility to provide the essentials for sustenance and for living, and foods and medicine and clothing and shelter. And if they're not providing it, they need to allow it to be provided by others. And at this point, we're in a situation where that's not happening. And again, I would call on Israeli society and institutions to work with us and understand that the work that we're doing is the best hope for long-term peace and stability. But if we undercut humanity at this base level, it's hard to see any hope for humanity, and certainly any hope for a peaceful coexistence.
I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but that the IDF has to approve individual drivers for convoys and also controls windows of time when they can drive. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's correct, particularly going up to the north. When you have to cross through conflict areas, then that has to be done. And as we've seen, many convoys have been attacked. World Central Kitchen convoys have been attacked in the past. This is not something that is brand new. It's just that this is the most shocking instance of, as we know now, hundreds, nearly 200 humanitarian workers have been killed and many more of their family members. So this is not the only attack on humanitarian aid workers, but it is certainly one of the most brazen and with the largest number of casualties, fatalities, with an organization that is highly visible and is highly respected for its laser focus on delivering as many dignified meals to people who are hungry as quickly and effectively as they can. And they're good at their job, and they're not political, and this shouldn't happen.
Sean Carroll is the CEO of ANIRA, American Near East Refugee Aid. It works closely with the World Central Kitchen distributing food aid in Gaza. Sean, thanks so much for speaking to us on this difficult day.
Thank you for having me.
We'll have more on how Israel chooses targets during wartime ahead this hour. Do you ever stay up late at night wrestling with questions like, what rhymes in French with isosceles triangle? No? Yeah, me neither. But here is a guy who does do that. His name is Antoine Carrier, and he's a middle school teacher in Bordeaux, France. But online, tens of thousands of kids know him as Arieka, the rapping math teacher. The World's Jerry Haddon reports.
Do you remember middle school math, fractions, decimals, a squared plus b squared, x to the power of n? For a lot of kids, this is tough stuff. So Arieka takes it slow, and I'll just get my one rhyme out of the way, makes it flow.
Les tables de multiplication. OK. Petite chanson sur les tables de multiplication. Les cinq premières sont à connaître sans hésitation. Table de 1, rien à apprendre. Table de 2, calcule le double. Table de 3, rajoute ton nombre de départ à ton double. Tu calcules le double du double. Pour la table de 4, pour 6 fois 4, 6 et 6, 12. 12 et 12, ça fait 20.
This rap walks 11-year-olds through multiplication tables. Without them, you can't pass pre-algebra, Arieka tells me. His rap, he says, turns math into something that goes in one ear, but not out the other.
En fait, c'est-à-dire qu'au lieu d'ouvrir un cahier, et de se dire, ah, je me remets dans ma leçon.
Instead of my students just opening a notebook and going over a lesson, feeling unmotivated, he says, they can go online, click on a rap, and study the material to the music. It keeps them focused, he says, especially at home. That's the magic of Rapamatiques. Arieka posted his first Rapamatiques, or rhyming math lesson, 2 years ago. In all his videos, the tattooed, hoodie-wearing 30-something teacher stands before a whiteboard, rapping and waving a Sharpie around like any rapper would, were they to find themselves, for some odd reason, holding a Sharpie. Arieka now has dozens of raps posted across his socials and nearly 90,000 followers on Instagram. Outside one middle school in Bordeaux, a group of students say they know Arieka's songs and they love what he's doing.
Moi, je trouve que c'est une bonne idée parce que les jeunes, souvent, ils écoutent beaucoup de musique. On connaît toutes les musiques par cœur.
It's a great idea, says 13-year-old Roxanne, because our generation listens to tons of music and we learn all the lyrics by heart. By contrast, she says, math is hard for us to absorb. The rap helps a lot.
Il faut comprendre, donc je pense, oui, ça pourrait aider pour les matières surtout scientifiques.
I wish other teachers, like for science, would do the same thing, says another girl named Eva. Actually, other teachers are making guest appearances.
Tu veux savoir à quoi ressemble ta fonction carrée?
On this rap about exponential numbers, Arieka colleague Chloe laughs on the mic, dropping mad rhymes about an inverted parabola aligned symmetrically along the y-axis.
L'axe des ordonnées, elle est symétrique. Calcule quelques images et tu peux tracer son graphique. Et garde-le bien en tête pour les équations, c'est pratique.
En ce qui concerne les équations du type x carré égale 16, il y a deux solutions.
Kind of cringy maybe, but the point's the same. Students can't unsee it, which means hopefully they won't forget it.
Ok, les angles. Un angle est une partie du plan délimité par deux demi-droites qui ont même origine, même départ. L'origine des deux.
Kids can scroll through Rapamatiques to learn about anything in their syllabus. Angles, order of operations, percentages, parameters. Each topic has its own beat and catchy refrain.
Quand je mets une nouvelle vidéo, ils ont tous été l'écouter. Ils arrivent le lendemain, ils chantent le refrain, quoi. Ils arrivent, ils chantent le refrain pour rigoler ou...
When I upload a new video, Arieka says, I get to school the next day and often the kids are already singing the chorus. And in singing along, the students are also answering for themselves that age-old existential middle school math question, why are we even learning this? Why? Because against all the laws of probability, math might just be kinda, sorta, cool.
15% d'une quantité, c'est 15 sur 100 fois cette quantité. Pour n'importe quel pourcentage.
For the world, I'm Jerry Hatton.
Pour n'importe quelle quantité, ça marche un prix, un poids ou des personnes. Si ta quantité de base se voit augmenter de ce pourcentage, ben tu dois lui rajouter ce que tu viens de trouver. Mais si c'est une diminution.
From the Be Careful What You Wear on Your Wrist department, Peru's embattled president is under investigation for acquiring an undisclosed collection of luxury watches in the past 3 years. That's been while she served in high government offices. President Dina Boluarte's modest state salary seemed out of sync with the Rolex watches she'd been seen wearing. One was valued up to $14,000. Police used a battering ram to raid her residence on Friday looking for the watches. Yesterday, six of her cabinet ministers resigned. Lawmakers have sent a request to Parliament to remove Boluarte for, quote, permanent moral incapacity. She has denied accusations of illicit enrichment. Peru has seen five presidents in the past 6 years. You are listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. If you're looking to find something online, you Google it, or you might ask a chatbot. But they appear to favor English, including when looking for answers to medical questions. In a new study, researchers translated 2,000 commonly asked medical questions into Mandarin, Hindi, and Spanish. The results are not promising. I asked Yi Qiao Jin for some examples of this. He's the study's primary author at the Georgia Institute of Technology.
When you are asking questions in, say, Chinese, for example, what is the complication of myopia, which means short sight? In this case, the English answer can be very comprehensive. For example, myopia is a common eye disease, and it can cause things like retinal detachment, vision loss, cataract, and amblyopia. Whereas in case of Chinese or Hindi, maybe it only answers that the myopia can cause retinal detachment or vision loss.
So a less complete answer in that case. Were there any answers that were just, you know, pretty wrong?
Definitely. So for example, in case you ask it something like, is hot water or cold water better for health? Actually, the correct answer depends. If you are an East Asian, maybe like hot water should be better for your health because that is what people have been drinking since they are like pretty young. Whereas for other countries, maybe cold water is better. But in this case, for Chinese answers, usually it just answers that, okay, cold water is definitely better. Hmm. Whereas it actually does not provide a more comprehensive view of what the correct answer is.
Hmm. And you chose Mandarin, Hindi, and Spanish for a reason. Why those languages?
These languages are the four most spoken languages around the world. I think English should be the most popular language around the world with the most first language speakers and second language speakers. And also languages like Chinese and Hindi have a lot of native speakers. So that's how we chose the languages.
And which of the three languages was the most problematic in terms of the answers that you got?
Among the three languages, most of the metrics, the model actually performs the worst in Hindi. It generates the least consistent answers when you are asking it the same questions for several times.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned these are the four most commonly spoken languages in the world. So there are lots of people who speak these languages, lots of data out there. But, you know, this seems to be just one of many examples we've heard about lately of artificial intelligence containing biases. Why exactly are the chatbots producing the wrong answers in these non-English languages?
So I think one of the most important reasons is that those chatbots are mainly trained on English corpuses, whereas those corpus usually contain a very small amount of non-English information. And also, even for those training data, maybe they are outdated. For example, they are collected a long time ago, which is maybe not suitable for this kind of large-scale training in the age of LLMs.
Large language models. So a chatbot is only as good as the stuff, the source material you feed into it. So is that kind of the solution here? Use more material from different languages in training these chatbots?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a good solution. It might be advisable to develop this kind of language agnostic architectures. For example, we use a shared vocabulary, or when you have a question in non-English languages, then you maybe have an intermediary step to first translate it mm-hmm. into English so that the model can provide you the best answers. And then after you get the answers, you translate back to the source language.
Yi Qiao Jin is a PhD student at Georgia Institute of Technology. Most migrants crossing illegally from Mexico to California go by land, but desperation has driven some people to attempt to swim. Tijuana and San Diego have seen a jump both in the number of migrants who are rescued and who have drowned in the attempt. KPBS reporter Gustavo Solis spoke to lifeguards on both sides of the border.
The sound of crashing waves and children playing along the Tijuana coastline lulls visitors into a false sense of security. But underneath the surface, there's a different story, particularly at the U.S.-Mexico border, where the wall sticks out more than 200 feet into the Pacific Ocean.
Nosotros le llamamos resaca. Creo que en Estados Unidos le dicen rip current.
Tijuana lifeguard captain Luis Hernandez says the metal post from the border wall create a permanent rip current that pulls swimmers out into the ocean. These waters are unforgiving.
Aquí no hay orillita, de que ya me cansé, me agarro de la orilla. No hay de dónde agarrarse.
This stretch of ocean is particularly dangerous to migrants trying to swim around the border. Over the last few years, Tijuana lifeguards have seen a record number of deaths. They track rescues and drownings on a whiteboard from their main lifeguard tower. Just 5 rescues in 2020 and only 7 in 2021. Then, 59 rescues in 2022 and 41 last year. Hernandez says migrants cross in one of two ways. The first is to just swim around the border, but fighting that powerful current is exhausting.
Entonces lo utilizan como si fuera escalón y se van agarrados de la reja.
The second is to wrap your arms around the wall's metal beams and use shellfish growing along the bottom of the wall as little ledges. But those shells are very sharp. Lifeguards often rescue migrants with cuts throughout their body.
Son como navajitas. Entonces eso hace que salgan con heridas en los pechos, en el pecho, en los brazos.
Most rescues happen on the San Diego side of the border, when exhausted migrants are swimming against that powerful rip current trying to get back to shore. Whenever that happens, U.S. lifeguards respond. Jason Lindquist is head lifeguard in Imperial Beach.
If we get a call from the Border Patrol that they're watching someone hang on the fence, or swim around the fence, or in distress, we try to respond no matter what, because it's in our city limit.
Lindquist says most rescues involve migrants who are not strong swimmers. They often jump into the ocean with all their clothes on and carry their belongings in heavy backpacks.
If the current pushes you against that fence, that's a dangerous situation because you can't get off of it. We've had, I think in the last 2 years, way more fatalities from here to the border than we've ever had.
A new study published by researchers at UC San Diego confirms what lifeguards are seeing in the water. Peter Lindholm and Anna Lucier found that drownings increased significantly after the wall was built, from just 1 drowning in the 4 years before to 33 in the 4 years after. To be clear, the study does not establish causation, nor does it attribute the drownings directly to the new border wall.
So I think it's important for the lifeguards, the emergency response systems, and the UC health system to know if we have a lot of drowning related accidents coming in. It's something that the healthcare system needs to handle.
Lucier is a PhD and medical student in San Diego. She became interested in migrant drownings during a rotation at the trauma surgery unit at UC San Diego Hillcrest Medical Center, where she saw a lot of injuries from people who fell from the border wall and wondered whether anyone just tried to swim around instead.
So I'm hopeful that the work that we do can kind of lay a framework for other researchers and other people who care about this issue to look into it further.
Although the drownings are relatively new in San Diego, they're much more common in other parts of the world.
Drowning during migration is one of the leading causes of death during migration around the world, especially around the Mediterranean area, and there hasn't been a lot of scientific investigation into that.
Both researchers called this a preliminary study. They'd like to analyze more data on drownings and rescues from both sides of the border.
For The World, I'm Gustavo Solis in Tijuana.
You're listening to The World. Disturbing stories from Australia of government workers removing newborns from their Aboriginal mothers without even telling them.
This is a repeat of the past. Taking children by stealth, taking children by force, putting children in non-Aboriginal care or in residential care.
That story ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The Israel Defense Forces, or IDF, is drawing criticism over how it selects targets in aid strikes. Earlier this hour, we heard about the attack on a World Central Kitchen aid convoy. Israel is also suspected in yesterday's airstrike on the Iranian embassy complex in Damascus, Syria. Shlomo Brome is a former Israel Defense Forces brigadier general. He's now a senior researcher at the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv. He defended the practice of striking residential neighborhoods like the embassy attack in Damascus.
The fact that this meeting was taking place in a completely residential area is the strategy of these militias and the Al-Quds force that are using the cover of a civilian residence for such a meeting.
So you're saying if any civilians were killed, that is the fault of the Quds forces deciding to have a meeting there instead of the Israeli military deciding to attack?
Not only it's their fault, but I still suspect that the so-called civilians were part of this meeting.
So you doubt that the people around the Iranian commanders were uninvolved?
I doubt it very strongly. That is a totally different case than the incident in Gaza.
Yeah, let's talk about that now. The World Central Kitchen convoy, three vehicles were blown up, reportedly in pursuit of one Hamas figure. How was that kind of targeting, which would necessarily kill multiple people as it did, how is that justified in the IDF?
First of all, I don't know whether this information is correct. Because the best of my knowledge, when this kind of attacks are carried out for the purpose of killing a certain Hamas operative, Hamas leader, Hamas commander, only one vehicle is targeted. I'm not aware of cases in which, a convoy of several vehicles is being targeted.
So what are you suggesting, that the three vehicles were not attacked?
What I am suggesting is that we don't have full information yet.
So if it turns out that this was a mistake, you know...
It's obviously a mistake. The question is, who made the mistake?
However, World Central Kitchen coordinated with the army. Yeah. They had highly visible markings on their cars and on their apparel, and yet still they were fired at. How do you think any aid organization might feel safe under those conditions?
First of all, if you operate in an area where fighting is taking place, you know that you are operating in a dangerous environment and that mistakes can be done. And I admire these people that operate under these conditions, but those are the conditions. Mm.
The heart of my questioning here is getting at this idea that Israel's acceptance of collateral damage has changed over the years. Can you walk me through the calculation that IDF currently makes when they're choosing whether to hit a target or not when it's in a residential area, such as with the strike in Damascus?
First of all, we are talking about a new kind of war. That is a war between the armed forces of a state, the state of Israel, and terrorist organization, guerrilla force, that is the enemy. The ones that are fighting against us is taking place in residential area. So that is the place when the fighting is going on.
So if a target that the IDF wants to strike is among civilians and would incur civilian deaths, how is that calculation made?
As I said, the vast majority of the attacks are taking place in this kind of environment.
Right. And so how does the IDF decide how many civilian deaths are warranted?
There are always civilians in the general area. But if there is a large number of civilians very close to the target, usually the decision is not to target it.
So earlier, I just want to recap something you were saying earlier. You're saying that the threat to Israel has increased and that Israel is justified in risking civilian lives when it goes after its enemies. Is that correct?
Of course it is correct. Because what is the alternative?
And so just how many civilian lives are worth risking when going after an enemy target? What is the calculation?
I don't know. I don't know and nobody knows. There is no formula for such a thing.
Has that bar been lowered? Has the number of acceptable civilian deaths gone up?
As I said before, because it is a full-blown war, then certainly the bar has been lowered. And it is always lowered. When the U.S. is invading Iraq, it is lowered. When there is a full-blown war against the Islamic State, it is lowered. You know how many civilians were killed in Mosul?
I don't off the top of my head.
I also don't know from my top of my head, but as far as I know, the ratio was not so different than the ratio is in Gaza now.
Do you think there is a limit? Do you think there's a line that the IDF will not cross in terms of how many civilians in Gaza will die?
Of course, there is a line the IDF will not cross. The first line is it will not intentionally attack innocent civilians.
It will not intentionally target innocent civilians.
As a target. We will not do it. We are all the time accused that we are doing it. We will never do it. Intentionally attacking innocent civilians. Collateral damage is something different. You are attacking a legitimate military target, and civilians are being hurt because of their proximity to this target. That is collateral damage. So that is one line that we will never cross.
Shlomo Brom is a former Israel Defense Forces Brigadier General. He's now a senior researcher at the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv. In South Australia, a government probe is revealing a disturbing practice. Aboriginal newborns have been taken from their mothers right in the hospital by the Department of Child Protection. In many cases, the women said they had no idea their babies were being removed. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports from Sydney.
For years, Mitzi Nam worked with expectant mothers, Aboriginal women like herself, but who were having a rough go. Her job was to help them get ready for motherhood.
We would pick them up to take them to their antenatal appointments and also try and help with housing, helping them get bassinets and cots and prams, whatever they needed for their babies. So, you know, preparing them for when the child is born.
But many women never came home with that child. Nam says the Department of Child Protection would take the newborn from the hospital without giving the moms any warning or explanation.
They were tricked by the nurses and the medical staff. These families didn't know what was happening or that the department was plotting to remove the child.
What was happening was that the women were getting reported to the Department of Child Protection even before their babies were born. Maybe they had older children that had been removed. Maybe they'd missed prenatal appointments. Maybe they had a history of substance abuse or domestic violence. Whatever it was, Nam says, the Aboriginal support workers like her were almost never notified. And mothers didn't know they'd been flagged until after their baby was taken away from them.
Once the baby was taken away, we couldn't even contact the women to see if they were okay. We couldn't refer them on to another service. So then they felt betrayed by us.
Nationwide, Aboriginal children are 10 times more likely to be removed from their families than non-Indigenous children. South Australia's Commissioner for Aboriginal Children, April Laurie, is leading an inquiry into her state's child protection system, a system that many experts say targets Aboriginal families and subjects them to a higher level of scrutiny. Over the course of her investigation, Laurie says she's heard some horror stories about how mothers figured out their babies had been taken.
It can be as a note found on their bed or running around the hospital trying to find out what's happened to their baby.
Laurie says hospital staff have been known to lie to mothers to get them out of the way.
I've heard a story of a mother being encouraged to smoke, go out for a cigarette. She came back and was like, you know, okay, my baby's not in the room. There's a note on my bed, folded up, and that note was a formal written notice about the baby going into the custody of the department. And she was most distressed and she was running around asking staff, where's my baby, where's my baby? No one would tell her. No one would tell her where her baby was.
After a child is removed, they're placed in out-of-home care. This can be foster care or sometimes the home of a friend or relative. Then there's a court hearing. If the judge agrees with child protection that the baby isn't safe at home, the mother will be given a list of things she needs to do in a given period of time to get her baby back. Most babies are never returned to their mothers. Mitzi Nam, who worked with expectant mothers, says this almost happened to her own daughter right after she had given birth in the hospital.
My daughter rang me, like, sobbing to say that she was told she wasn't going home. The nurse that had been working with her had documented that she had no family supports. So I rang up and I explained that my daughter was living at home. Her partner was still with her, and I was actually an antenatal and postnatal support worker. Had I not made those phone calls, I may have never seen my first grandchild come home.
no one at the Department of Child Protection in South Australia has publicly defended the practice of removing newborns from Indigenous mothers without notifying them beforehand. At a public hearing in November, Adam Riley, the deputy head of the department, said it shouldn't be happening.
All I can say is that I will always defend the work of our staff, but I'll never defend the indefensible. And what you've described, I can't find a rational response to support that action. I would genuinely apologise to those families for that experience. It's unacceptable.
The World reached out to South Australia's Department of Child Protection for comment, but they didn't get back to us by airtime. Critics have been saying for years that Australia is in the midst of a second stolen generation. That period from about 1910 and into the 1970s, when thousands of Aboriginal children were literally stolen from their communities by governments, churches, and welfare bodies and assimilated into white society. Dr. BJ Newton is a child protection expert at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. She says the similarities between the past and present aren't coincidental. Racism, she says, is built into the very bones of the system.
The current child protection system in Australia is one that was founded upon removing Aboriginal children from their families for the purposes of assimilation and genocide.
In 2008, then Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd apologized for the actions of successive Australian governments in forcibly removing Indigenous children from their families. But April Laurie, the South Australian Commissioner for Aboriginal Children, says saying sorry means you don't do it again.
This is a repeat of the past. Taking children by stealth, taking children by force, putting children in non-Aboriginal care or in residential care, and it needs to stop.
Her final report on Aboriginal child removals is expected later this year. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum, Sydney.
The Japanese government says it will sell fighter jets to some allies. This marks a shift after decades of pacifism since World War II. It comes coincidentally as the film Oppenheimer opens in Japan, depicting the first atomic bombs dropped on Japan at the end of that war. Jennifer Coates is a professor of Japan studies at the University of Sheffield in England and describes the conversations around Oppenheimer.
So the people that I discussed the screenings with said that viewers didn't want to be sort of protected from the contents of the film or to see any kind of, you know, redacted or edited version. They really wanted to see what everyone else has been talking about for 8 months.
And were the criticisms mostly along the lines of telling the story from Oppenheimer's perspective and not showing the impact the dropping of the bombs had on Japanese people?
I think that's concerned a lot of viewers. But other viewers have said, look, it's a story from the American perspective. Japanese viewers are very, very used to seeing film narratives about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki from the Japanese perspective. So I think there's also a degree of kind of interest in that. How do U.S. governments and historians speak to their own people about what happened?
So following the nuclear attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan outlawed war as a means to settle international disputes in its constitution. Can you tell me about the reasoning behind that?
The fact that Japan has a pacifist constitution does not necessarily make it a country that has not been involved in war since that constitution was ratified, if that makes sense. So in some ways, I think what we're seeing with this latest sort of, I guess we might call it an update or a redefinition of this idea of pacifism, is sort of more another one in a long line of redefinitions and reimaginings of what being a pacifist country looks like. Unfortunately, I think many people would say, especially in Japan, being a country with a pacifist constitution for Japan has never meant not being involved in war.
So this decision to sell fighter jets that Japan is developing, does it mark, you know, a larger change in how Japan is seeing itself?
I think it's been coming for a long time, this idea that Japan has to reimagine a little bit what we might call, I guess, its responsibility for its own defense and security. Again, even as early as the 1950s, there was some unease in American political circles about what Japan being a pacifist country meant for the US in terms of the burden that it might be taking on to sort of defend and protect its ally. And of course, at the same time, the US has been very keen not to lose Japan as an ally. So I think it's always been a bit of a difficult political task to imagine what does a pacifist country look like. But definitely, I think against the political and kind of war oriented, maybe global background that we have today, this question has become a lot more pressured.
Is there anything in, specifically that's triggered this increasing willingness to do things like sell fighter jets in Japan, or is it just that ongoing changing of understanding of self-defense?
I think that's definitely part of it. There's also quite a bit of worry about military activities in China and in Russia. Another thing that I found people very keen to talk about and very concerned about is Japan's economic situation. The yen is very, very weak. And although Japan is considered to have, I think, rallied from the shocks of the pandemic, there is an awareness that the Japanese economy is not particularly strong. And of course, selling arms internationally is one of the main ways that many other countries are boosting their economy.
So how is the government reconciling its constitution with the sale of these jets?
Most of what we're seeing coming from the Ministry of Defense this week has been sort of, you know, reassurances along the lines of, we're still a country with pacifist principles. You know, we're not going to renounce Article 9 anytime soon. But watching Article 9 be sort of bent and twisted is something that I think that Japanese voters have been seeing for a very long time.
Jennifer Coates is a professor of Japan Studies at the University of Sheffield in England. Coming up, we meet a young woman who took her parents' mixtapes and launched a cultural archive. Music from Sudan just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Haneen Seed Ahmed grew up in Oakland, California, listening to tapes of her parents' music from Sudan. Seed Ahmed wanted to share the music, so in 2020, she got a cassette deck and a digitizer and started uploading the classic songs of Sudan. When war broke out in Sudan last April, she realized her work was more urgent than she first thought. Hana Baba from station KALW has her story.
Haneen Seed Ahmed pulls a plastic box of tapes out from a shelf in her living room.
I have different collections. So the one I'm pulling out right now is, you know, from my dad's collection, so it's the OG collection.
The OG collection,
you know, I have the ones I got from Sugum Durman, and they're like mine, but, you know,
Tell me some names here.
So we have Samira Dunya, Kalam al-Nas, we have Asam Muhammad Noor, we have Ahmed al-Mustafa, Samiri.
Haneen is a true diaspora kid. Born in Germany, grew up in Saudi Arabia and Sacramento, California. But one thing was constant. Her mom and dad always played their music.
My favorite song growing up was actually Rahmak Ya Malak in that tape. It was called Ya Raya by Ahmed al-Mustafa. We had an old, like, 1991 Camry. It was the first car we got when we immigrated to the States. And I remember it was the tape that was played the most. So I just, and it was like, I remember it was like side A, song number one.
And her mom, she says, loved the celebratory music, the wedding songs.
This one is iconic. This is Gisma al-Adil Wazin. This is the Dirtik tape. This is a favorite of mine. So Gisma is essentially part of this genre known as Aghani Banat, or women's music. And a lot of this music is very integral to the Sudanese wedding process. So the song Al-Adil Wazin is played in every Sudanese wedding. Yeah, I would say every Sudanese woman who has gotten married has had this exact portion of the song played. This is when it gets exciting. Like, you know it's about to start when this song plays. So this is a classic. This is everything.
العدل وزين
نولي إلى العدل ويا رسول الله
Haneen is a communications specialist at a university by day and does her archiving in the evenings. I ask her, why is this so special to you?
My experiences being, you know, Sudanese and growing up in the States and really trying to find things that anchor your identity. So I think the thing with Sudan is there isn't this huge, entertainment industry where, you know, there's a lot of cultural exports. For example, you know, like my South Asian friends, they had like Bollywood to refer to anchor themselves. And I was like, oh, like I wish I had something like that. But given the circumstances in Sudan, it wasn't always accessible. So it was my own process of excavating my heritage and my identity.
First, it was a personal project, but as more and more people discovered her SoundCloud page where she posted the music, she knew this was bigger.
It became a huge, like, source of nostalgia for people. Like, a lot of people were commenting, like, oh my God, like, you know, my dad has passed away, but he used to play this tape, and, like, I've been looking for it for so long. So I think, like, other people saw it as like a reclamation of memories that have been forgotten, because so much of the music hasn't necessarily made it onto streaming platforms.
But then in April 2023, war broke out in Sudan. The devastation was massive. Homes and banks looted. And iconic sites and centers of culture were a target too, including museums, booksellers, and university libraries. The Rapid Defense Forces militia attacked and took control of the country's main broadcaster, the Sudan National Radio Corporation, home to a cherished music history library. While it has been taken back now by the army, it's not clear how much damage has been done to the library, and observers and historians fear the worst, that possibly the musical memory of Sudan is at risk.
I think she did an incredible job with this.
Journalist and historian Ismail Kushkush uses Haneen's archive. A friend brought it to his attention a couple of years ago. He likes listening to the prophet-praising songs from her collection. And he was in Sudan when the war began.
As not only, you know, shops have been ransacked, you know, the doctor's street, I mean, which was known for many of those music shops, that one can only imagine that these are places that have been destroyed, and, you know, audio cassettes in private homes, and as homes have been looted, there is a need for an effort to collect, to digitalize, to preserve these recordings so that Sudan's history is not lost.
I ask Haneen, does she feel more urgency to archive music since the war? More than 1 million people have fled to neighboring countries. What does this project mean, knowing that many Sudanese don't know if they will ever go back to Sudan, including maybe Haneen herself? She recalls her trip to Sudan in January 2023, before the war.
And I got a new batch of tapes from Sugum Durman. And now that same Sugum Durman is literally, like, raised to the ground. So I think it was, now there's this, like, undercurrent of, oh, our heritage is actively being destroyed. And these initiatives that are going to happen mostly in the diaspora are probably going to play an integral role in preserving Sudanese culture. And I think it feels more urgent and serious for me now.
And there's one group of people she's thinking about now more than ever.
There's generations of kids who are not gonna have the same access. They're not gonna have the summer trips or the December trips back to Sudan. I think, like, there's gonna be this sense of being unanchored.
And she hopes her music archive can be one anchor for future generations. For The World, I'm Hanat Baba in Oakland, California.
This story about the Sudan Tapes Archive comes to us via Hanat Baba's podcast, The Stoop. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Be good to each other and join us right back here tomorrow.